time, but that's because we have so much interesting material and remarks to exchange and comment upon. Certainly already been stimulating today, I think. And now we're going to have the pleasure to hear from Ambassador de Alba, who is the permanent representative of Mexico to the United Nations in Geneva. He has a distinguished career as a servant of his country, as a diplomat. Not least, he was the first president of the Human Rights Council, which I guess will be forever an interesting claim. And he played a significant role in that regard, some might say a rescuing process, and also shepherding in what is now, I think, more of a success than some of us might have anticipated, though it's still some time before we'll be able to evaluate fully, which is the Universal Periodic Review, which might have some connection even to what we're discussing here. Ambassador de Alba graced us earlier this year at the University of Essex by accepting to give a lecture in the series of events we held in celebration of our 25th anniversary of the Human Rights Center at the University of Essex in March of this year, at which on which occasion he shared candidly and interestingly for all of us a number of reflections about the real challenges within the Human Rights Council and of negotiating or conducting international diplomacy in the field of human rights. Let me also say that Ambassador de Alba brings into this work not only a sense of the art of the possible, which is crucial, of course, but also a real sensitivity to what human rights are about and what the prospects of multilateralism can achieve. And so it's within that context that I'm especially pleased to be able to invite him to make some remarks, and then he'll receive some questions.
Thank you very much, Professor Parker and Professor Brennan. Thank you very much for the invitation. Let me start by underlining what Professor Parker just said, that I am basically a diplomat, so I need to start by confessing that I felt that like a student the whole morning, learning, which I appreciate very much. But myself, I'm not going to try to rise to the level of discussion of the presentation this morning in terms of its deepness and substantive comment. Rather, I would prefer to give you some ideas, some thoughts, and probably some of them may be a provocative thought, some things that I think are needed to be associated with this discussion. First of all, let me say that I believe that from a human rights perspective, the priority number one is to prevent violations. And in that sense, I think we need to broaden the discussion and to have an approach that will encompass the past as well as the present, and hopefully the future, and that we consider the question of reparation, redressing human rights violations in a context on which we will not shift the focus on preventing violations. Because if you just read the report of the newly appointed special rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery, you will see that she has identified 27 million victims of contemporary forms. And I think it would be extremely important to have this broader approach, and then to extract from the analysis of the history what can be done actually to improve the situation, and obviously to reduce that number as quickly as possible. I think it would be also very important to, within this broader context, to see what the role of developing countries is. Because I had the feeling this morning that we were talking very much about the trade of slaves from the south to the north. But in most cases, and I will use the example of my own country, Mexico, the responsibilities of our governments relate to our own population already. We cannot, and you will never find anybody in Mexico talking about the relationship with Spain at this time. This is not an issue, even though there was a slave trade, and not only because it was relatively marginal, no more than 1% of our population, but mainly because the issue for us is the relationship with indigenous population. You will have some parallels on the discussion and some specificities. And one of the most important specificities would be to acknowledge the level of development, the resources, the capacity of redressing a situation. On the one hand, the resources, and obviously the political will, which in that case is still more or less the same as a developed country, but also a much more nuanced situation, which is dealing with a population that may be mixed in a large percentage. Taking again the Mexican example, you have basically 10% of the population that may be considered indigenous, but you still have 80% of the population that is considered mixed. And making the difference between the mixed or population and the purely indigenous present huge challenges. And when you talk about affirmative action or reparation or any form of compensating hundreds of years of injustices, becomes extremely difficult. First, because you can have, you need to start by the definition itself of who is an indigenous and who is not, which is basically a recognition, a self-recognition on the part of the person. And some indigenous do not even try to identify themselves as indigenous because they don't want to be subject of further discrimination. So that's the very beginning. Second, you have the problem of dividing groups of population that may face very similar problems, levels of poverty, huge levels of poverty, bad education, etc., on which you cannot address direct programs to one part of the population only on the basis that they are indigenous and not to do it with the other part. And this is a huge challenge. So the question of how do you compensate comes very much to the center of our debates. We were talking this morning, and it's something we talk very frequently in Mexico, to develop programs that will address economic and social benefits by region rather than by groups or by individuals. But still, we face some difficulties. And let me give you something which is a little bit ironic. Since our independence and up to 2000, we considered that all Mexicans should be treated equally and we should not make any distinction between Mexicans. And so, as you can see now, with this kind of approach that you can develop regions and groups, fits more or less okay. But in 2000, a constitutional change was introduced, which I think it was wonderful. Some may differ to that, but personally I think it was wonderful, on which in 2000 the constitution made a difference between indigenous and non-indigenous people. And I think it was wonderful because it was the recognition of a failure, because we have not been able to build really an equal society for Mexicans and we needed some affirmative action. But now it goes exactly against what's supposed to be the policy that we all wanted, to have regional development and to have regions rather than individuals benefiting from the special programs. And this is the dilemma in which we are today. We developed as strongly as we could initiatives in the United Nations to protect the rights of indigenous people. We were very much at the forefront of the negotiations on the Universal Declaration lately, and we hope that by introducing a very wide analysis and debate on the implementation of the declaration, we will be able to draw ourselves some guidelines to deal with the issue. By the way, that was the first, strictly speaking, it was the second decision of the Human Rights Council. The first one was to approve the Convention on Enforced Disappearance, and the second one to adopt the declaration. And I think it needs to be considered in the context of this meeting also, in as much as the declaration itself addresses the question of reparation. And obviously, there is a question of respecting. Sometimes there are treaties or agreements, some other kinds, or some other times, even without written documents, there are claims that need to be respected in terms of land, particularly religious sites, etc. And there are some experiences already going on. I will stop with the part that relates to Mexico, just by telling you that for the time being, there is no way in Mexico that an indigenous person or group could be able to litigate in a tribunal a particular right, and that's quite a bad news. But on the other side, there is a political will to address those issues, and we have developed an interesting project that I hope will continue, which is a project that by identifying the problems in a particular community, particular group of indigenous people, frequently we identify that the main problem is obviously the land property. And in some cases, the land has been taken from them by force. Some others, they have even been part of a deal by which they sold the land. And it is impossible to give it back to them in most cases because new development has taken place or all. But we have accepted the principle that we need to not to repay, but to restitute. I think I can say that the same amount of land, not in the same place, but the same amount, and that has been working because it involves obviously consultations with the group, because it's not any land that they may be interested. But by trying to shift and compensate the loss, it has been working. What we still need is to be able to do it this. Less from a political will that may be dependent on a particular government to a state policy and eventually to a legally binding obligation of the government. Coming back to the UN, I feel I need to defend a little bit the system and to tell you that even though some people think that it is almost impossible to get an agreement among 192 countries, that it takes too long and sometimes the result is too poor. Let me start by telling you there is no other option. Bilateral agreements, bilateral negotiations will never be a substitute of a multilateral arrangement. Not only in terms of the scope, but also in terms of the long-term guarantees that we all need. At the bilateral level, again, we depend very much on the political will of a particular government, a particular deal that can be revoked or forgotten very, very soon. At the multilateral level, we are building block by block, if you want, but we are building something which can be referred back several years later. And in that context, I want to highlight two new developments that really referred or close to the topics we are talking today or we are addressing today. The first one is the transformation of the mandate of the working group on contemporary forms of slavery into a special rapporteur. And this mechanism has been reinforced, and I think it needs to be supported and follow up. We will need to give the honor mandate holders some time to develop the program. Has already been outlined. If any of you do not have a copy and would like a copy of the first report of the special rapporteur, I have a copy here, and obviously it is available in the internet. So I think it is a development that we need to follow because we have enhanced the visibility of the topic within the council. And the second mechanism that I would like to refer to is precisely the Universal Periodic Review. The Universal Periodic Review, I will try to describe it very briefly. If you have any question how it works, I will go back to it. But just for the sake of the discussion, it is the only really innovative mechanism from the UN perspective. It is a procedure by which all 192 countries, the human rights situation are going to be reviewed by the Council itself. In order to review the situation of a particular country, we will rely on three documents. One document presenting this situation, kind of a picture of the situation of human rights in a particular country, produced by the country and the review itself. That's a document of 20 pages, that there is a procedure to elaborate, that there is a kind of a guideline so that all reports will be more or less comparable. There is an invitation, very clear invitation for the government to produce that document in consultation with civil society, with the contribution of National Commission of Human Rights, wherever they exist and apply, follow the principle, the Paris Principles. But it is a document which is supposed to be very substantive, and it's going to be presented every 4 years. The first one is rather, as I mentioned, a picture. And the second 4 years later, we have to show an evolution. But the review also includes two additional documents, one of 10 pages on which the Office of the High Commissioner will gather all the information available about that country, coming from treaty bodies, special procedures, special missions if they have taken place, etc. All the information within the system of what the situation of human rights is, again, with a guideline that will give relevance to all rights, not to focus only on a particular sphere. And that document will be complemented by the third document, which is again 10 pages, that are going to be the result of a compilation that the Office of the High Commissioner will do from information coming from civil society, NGOs, and other actors, including, again, whenever it's appropriate, information from the national institutions, National Commission for Human Rights. With these 40 pages, which, by the way, give official status to NGOs for the first time in the history of the UN. It is the first time on which you will have a paper with the views of NGOs, with the emblem, the symbol of the UN, and you will be able to use that document in the questioning of the government or in commenting the results of the process. With these four documents, we move into an exercise of dialogue, precisely on which we can make comments and questions during a three-hour period. During those 3 hours, any government, member of the Council or non-member observer, can make a question or a comment. And then a troika, composed by three rapporteurs chosen among the members of the Council, will produce a report. The most important element is that the report that will be issued by this working group will need to get to specify recommendations that have been presented to that government. We will identify in a different place those that have been accepted by the government in question and those who have not been, but all recommendations will be on the document. But it can also include commitments by the government. And that's probably, from my point of view, the most important element, because we can put pressure on governments to enlarge the number of commitments they are making. And in 4 year term, we will be able to ask them whether they have complied or not. And this is not going to be the opinion of Mexico reviewing the situation in the UK in a traditional bilateral politicized way. I will be asking if just to keep this example of Mexico asking the UK, I will be asking the UK whether they have complied or not with their own commitments. It would not be whether Mexico considers that it was important for the UK to do A, B, or C. I will be asking them, what have you done in relation to A, B, or C commitment that you have freely undertaken? And this is a place on which we can also talk about the past, and we can talk about reparations and other issues. The United Kingdom, by the way, has already gone through this process. I don't remember that the issue of slavery or was raised. But issues like migration, which is a new form of contemporary form of slavery, was very much in the forefront of the discussion. Unfortunately, we didn't get any specific commitment from the UK. And I'm using the example of the UK only because I am in the UK, but I can tell you that we tried to get commitment from the Swiss or from the French, which already went through this process also, and they have not yet committed. We will see how it goes. Mexico is one of the countries that will be reviewed in the future, quite soon. The next cycle of review would be in November, and the following one would be February. Mexico will be reviewing February, together with some other big countries in terms of human rights interests, like China or Cuba. So we'll see how it goes. But this is a procedure which has two, three advantages as I see it, and I would like to probably end the presentation there and then answer a specific question. The first one is that it allows, not only it allows a country to make additional commitments to whatever obligation they have already acquired through the signing and ratification of a treaty, but most importantly, it allows the Council to review the human rights situation in a country beyond the obligations, because we will be building, by going through this process, we will be building what I will call universal standards, so that we can ask questions and we can make recommendations on the basis of those universal values. And that implies that the government, regardless of whether they have ratified a particular convention, the case I prefer to refer always is obviously the Convention on the Rights of Migrants and their families, which have not been ratified by any receiving country. The fact that they have not ratified will not exempt them from replying questions on the treatment of migrant workers in their territories, social benefits, detention policies, etc. And that would be quite important because it will really enlarge the scope on which the human rights performance of a country is going to be evaluated. This goes very much with the origin of the Human Rights Council, and it's not a commercial, but it is something that we had a slogan at the beginning which said, all rights for all people in all places. This is the only way we can achieve that, because if we continue to rely on bilateral, regional, or treaties to commit governments, it will take much longer. But if we make a good use of the universal periodic review, at least in a cycle of 4 years, we will be able to cover all of it. Why 4 years is quite simple. Maybe you may ask why not sooner than that. It's a question of resources and feasibility. We are talking about reviewing the situation of 48 countries by year. That was the maximum that we could do. That implies 6 weeks of session devoted only to the UPR. In addition to the sessions that the Council itself will devote, because the results of the UPR will be presented in a Council session through a 1 hour consideration each of the reports, that means several additional hours in plenary. And we will not be in a position to review faster, but, and that will be my last point, the review is open. So that any country that goes into the process, and picking up again the case of the UK, who has already gone through, they could report back to the Council on a yearly basis. They don't need to wait 4 years to report back. and we should encourage that, the reporting, which is more frequent, even if there is not a 3-hour session to evaluate the result, but at least a more frequent reporting. The civil society is very actively participating in that process from the beginning. It will certainly be participating very much into the implementation of the recommendations, and the reporting could be done in a parallel way, because you would have the country reporting and the NGOs immediately validating or questioning the reports, and I think that would be the future. I will stop there because I promise not to talk too much, but let me thank you again and be ready to reply to any question. I omit a little bit the question of migrants in terms of a bilateral discussion, even though Professor Shelton this morning referred to the Braceros payment. Let me just put it in a bilateral tone, that that's a wonderful exercise. The fact that we are getting back to that 10% for the Braceros earnings, but it would be much better to stop the exploitation of migrant workers and to pay real salaries, and we should look into the situation of migrant workers beyond the question of paying that 10%. We are having problems of killing of migrants crossing the border, periods of detention which are absolutely unacceptable, mixture of children, women and adults. So I will welcome very much to look into that issue beyond the immediate success, and let's hope that the new administration in the U.S. is willing to do so. I express my wish that it will be so. Thank you.
So can we have a couple of questions from the floor, please?
Sorry, you mentioned the Braceros. Was the Mexican government involved in any way in that comments or reparations to the Braceros?
Yes, it was. I cannot tell you to which extent, but I know that we lobbied for a while and the embassy was very much involved, and the payment is going to be done through the Mexican authorities. The Interior Ministry is setting a special commission, so that, because you need to identify the beneficiaries and in some cases the relatives of the beneficiaries, but it is an exercise who has involved bilateral negotiations.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Your Excellency, what is your view on the relationship between CERD and the Human Rights Council? Because in some ways CERD has been trying to do what you have just described.
So what is CERD?
The difference between the CERN, the committee, and the UPR is that the UPR covers all subjects. We developed this system, first of all, with a clearly idea that we should not substitute treaty bodies. That whenever you have a treaty body following implementation of a particular treaty, the UPR should not intervene. We should be particularly careful not to undermine any recommendation coming up from a treaty body. But the UPR can give you the perspective. All 9 main core treaties on human rights, not only CERN, the 10, which is going to enter into force soon, I hope that it's already being taken to some extent, which is enforced disappearances, but we are dealing with disabilities, we are dealing with political rights, civil rights, the whole scope. The relationship between the treaty bodies and the UPR has not been easy at the beginning, particularly from the treaty bodies' perspective. But if you look, I can recommend to you a paper, a discussion of Madame Chanet. She wrote a report for the coordinating committee of the treaty bodies a few weeks ago. I don't remember exactly, but 3-4 weeks on which she put her own vision of how the two mechanisms should interact and support each other, and it's highly positive about UPR. I mean, Jeanette identified a lot of areas on which the work of treaty bodies could be strengthened by the work of the UPR. The only concern is the one I mentioned, that through the UPR we will not weaken recommendation. It is a real challenge, because you may have a recommendation from a treaty body that the government in question has not accepted, and that government could use that recommendation to put it in the mouth of another country during the UPR, just to be able to reject it. And then they will say that they have rejected this particular recommendation and undermine the authority of the treaty body. So we have to be very careful not to repeat recommendations that have been presented by treaty bodies that will be only an excuse for the government to reject. Because in the treaty bodies system, whether you like it or not, the recommendation rests a recommendation. In the UPR, you still have this possibility of committing to implement only those that you have agreed. All recommendations that are not agreed are highlighted in a separate section of the report. That was the compromise we were forced to achieve. But the good thing is that we are able to have a report with all recommendations, regardless of whether they have all been accepted. Let me give you something which is very interesting, another note on the UPR. Something which is happening today is quite, I think it's quite good for human rights. A lot of countries are accepting more recommendations that they would normally do, because in as much as those recommendations are coming from developing countries. If they are not coming only from European sources, if Mexico puts a recommendation, and that's a real case, a very tough recommendation on Algeria, Algeria took it because it was coming from Mexico. It would have never accepted that recommendation coming from France. So this is the process on which we are building, putting pressure and complementing the work of both treaty bodies and the UPR.
Thank you. Any other questions? There's a question just here.
He has said with the UPR that eventually states will have also commitments in the procedure that you will go ahead within the council. After the 4 years, when you evaluate again the situation of that particular state, if it's in breach of that commitment, what then comes next? Is the council going to be able to sanction the state for not applying that commitment, or what will go next?
Well, that's a very good question and difficult to answer. It all depends on what the problem is. If you are talking about a serious violation of human rights, we will not even consider it within the UPR. We will address that through the regular agenda of the Council, and eventually we will call for a special session of the Council to address that because of the gravity and the urgency of the issue. If you are talking about a commitment, let's imagine that the country committed to reform a particular law, to ratify a particular treaty, and they have not been able to do it in 4 years, most likely the Council will only reiterate its own recommendations. But at least we will have to receive an explanation of why they didn't comply with it. Because it was their own decision. It was not imposed on them. And this strength, political strength of the recommendation is precisely the one that comes from the fact that it is the state who has accepted voluntarily. We have cases of countries who have volunteered to go to the UPR before their turn, because the whole cycle, the turn of countries that are going to be reviewed, the troikas that are going to be selected, everything is being done by the drawing of lots. There is a process which is quite open and transparent. And some countries have committed, I will mention the case of Colombia, for instance, on which Colombia committed to go before drawing the lots as soon as possible. And obviously they are coming with a set of commitments in addition to the obligations that they have, and they have already presented all those documents. So in a sense, even before the UPR, there is already additional material that can be used by civil society, other actors in the country to put pressure on the government to comply with their own commitments. The idea of making voluntary pledges started to develop at the time countries were seeking to get elected to the Council. But this is a very unilateral move, which is part of your own campaign to get elected. At the UPR level, the fact that we, member states as a whole, can give a follow-up to the recommendation changed the nature of that recommendation.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to have to stop there because the next panel is about to speak.
Just one more. Okay,
please.
This innovative procedure, I think, is very interesting, and thank you for clarifying this. There is one issue also which I think is important, that what happens in Geneva in the Council is, of course, transparent, is public, that's important. But how is the interaction to the domestic level? Because it is, of course, depends on every country, but it is important that the discussion in Geneva is being followed up at a national level, that commitments made are made known also at the national level. What can the Council do, in fact, to encourage also this sort of national involvement? It is, of course, at the end of the day, dependent on the state to implement that. But I think the national human rights commissions and other actors at the national level, what can the Council do to encourage that?
Well, I think we have done quite a lot already. First, we are transmitting through webcast all sessions of the Council and all sessions of the UPR. So you can follow the debate of the discussion on any of the topics from the capitals. You don't need to be in Geneva. You can even go back if any of you is interested in seeing how the UPK behaved or what kind of questions he got. Some funny recommendations. One of them was to get rid of the monarchy, for instance. You can go back to the UPR, and you will see which countries are doing a serious exercise. And this is very important in terms of the follow-up from the capitals. The second element, not only of transparency through the webcast, is the fact that we are encouraging delegations to come to Geneva at a high level. Most of them have come at the level of ministers, and with a mixed delegation that will involve ministries of justice, ministries of interior, not only ministries of foreign affairs. Once again, using the case of the UK, it was the Minister of Justice, the one who presented the situation in the UK. And we can also encourage participation from others by not only the process of preparation of the report, which necessarily involves a lot of consultation with different authorities, but by identifying who is going to be responsible of the follow-up of any of the recommendations. Because the government can take the recommendation as a whole, but then immediately can start, and this is something we are working with Argentina and some other colleagues, because GRULAC is moving a little faster than, I'm sorry to say it, but it is moving faster than the European Union. We are already thinking into 2-3 additional steps, and one of them would be to have kind of a program of action for implementation, identifying specific timetables and responsible authorities within the country. We are working, because this is one of the missing parts of the institutional building package, on the relationship with parliaments. We left the parliamentarians a little bit on the side, and since a lot of recommendations are going to be in terms of adequately changing legislation, we will need parliamentarians also to be very much important to the follow-up. But that's what we have been able to do in addition to the question of public transparency, if you want. I just want to make a point. has been possible because I took the initiative and the Swiss were ready to pay. But it has not been guaranteed institutionally. And it will need to be guaranteed institutionally. I mean, all meetings of the council are being broadcast, but it's costly. Geneva doesn't even have a TV set on a permanent basis, so we need to hire people to come from Bern to broadcast, etc. So this is the kind of difficulty that the process may still face. There is another problem which I also need to highlight. The Troikas and the members of the council who put the questions and the recommendations to the countries under review may include independent experts, and no delegation up to today have included an independent expert in their own team, and I think we need to move forward there. We need to keep the diplomatic limits of our discussion so that it will be gradual and productive, but still we can inject expertise into the delegations in presenting the questions. You can also send questions to the country under review on your own name, and you can send it to the countries that are going to be in charge of the review. But this system is going to be optional. It could be a system on which members of the council could pick up on questions that have been suggested to be raised at a particular review process. I personally think it's going to be very, very useful, because I know a lot of delegations that do not have enough time to prepare the questions and to review the situation. We are talking about reviewing the situation in every single member of the UN. Last time Mexico reviewed the situation of Tonga, and let me confess that it was not much the information we had about Tonga. At the moment, we were asked to put some questions and make some recommendations. So we rely quite a lot not only on the information provided by them, but also on the information provided by NGOs and other actors. This is a process that may enrich itself if we do a good use of it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for. Chair of the next session.